Welcome everyone. It's a great pleasure to welcome Mark Fleischman to Oxford. I know there are a few people in this room who work on performance histories, performance reception of Greek tragedy, who, like me, will have known of Mark's work for some years now. What was particularly striking for anyone working on Greek tragedy and performances of Greek tragedy was how much interest and extraordinary creativity there was around engagements with Greek tragedy in the New South Africa. And Mark was, as both scholar, as we were here tonight, and also theatre director of a company called, professional theatre company called Magnet Theatre Company, based in Cape Town. Mark was really at the forefront of this radical engagement with Greek tragedy, and not just with one or two, but with a number of tragedies, and they have led in turn to his successful bid for funding, and he now has this really exciting 5-year grant to explore reimagining tragedy from Africa, a South African perspective, that he, I think, is going to share with us tonight. So thank you so much for coming here and for sharing what we know is going to be, and already is, a very exciting series of practical experiments and discussions that you're having in South Africa and with colleagues elsewhere in Africa. So thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. And thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to talk about the work. It is a great privilege to be here. Before I start with the formal presentation per se, a couple of notes. The first is that I am...
Sorry, did you not want the lights off?
Yeah, that's good for the screen, but very difficult for me to read. Is there a light on? Oh, this is a light.
No, there should be a light on the left hand.
There we go.
Sorry.
So, first of all, I am not a classicist. I do not speak or understand any Greek, modern or ancient. My relationship to the archive, if you like, of Greek drama, ancient Greek drama, is entirely through translation. And even when I have been inspired by work in Greek, it wasn't because I understood anything linguistically that was happening on the stage. So I'm coming at this as a theatre studies academic and as a theatre director. The second thing is, those of you who are in the audience and are British cannot absolve yourselves from being counted as European for this talk, despite what is about to happen on Friday. And the third is that during the course of the talk, I will be showing a couple of some clips from a recent production that I've done. They will be slightly lengthy, but I feel the work does need to speak for itself. But on the other hand, it comes with a disclaimer that any attempt to film live performance will necessarily depreciate the quality of the experience. So we'll just have to take it as it is, accept the compromises. So the first part of the presentation deals with the project that brings me here to Oxford today. It's a project called Reimagining Tragedy from Africa and the Global South, or RETAGS. It's funded by the Mellon Foundation, and it takes place over a 5-year period, of which we've just come to the end of the first. And it's a project that proposes to take the concept tragedy from the very beginnings of theatre in its European manifestation, and therefore of the discipline of theatre studies, which is decidedly European, and to reimagine it from a perspective in Africa that is at once directed at the complex challenges of our global post-colonial present and towards our possible futures both inside and outside of the theatre. Through my research and my teaching of students in the university for the past 30 years, I have encountered the numerous adaptations and stagings of ancient tragedies by major writers and theatre makers across the African continent. And it really does stretch across the entire continent. I've also been inspired by the concept of African tragedy as outlined by Soyinka, for example, in his essay from the 1960s, The Fourth Stage. Sorry, I'm forgetting that I'm supposed to do that. Okay. There is something about these plays and their playing that appeals to African theatre makers, performers and audiences. My project sets out to interrogate this vast body of work produced in the theatres of Africa. Furthermore, it uses performance methodologies as analytical tools to gain purchase on the complex realities of the colonial aftermath by investigating current events in the post-colony beyond the theatre through the prism of tragedy. Importantly, the project also makes space to challenge the Eurocentric biases and preconceptions of theatre studies in two respects. First, by shifting and thereby challenging the perspective from which it operates and the assumptions that align with this predominant perspective. And second, by challenging its predominant methodologies by engaging art practice as a mode of research in a central way alongside other more conventional research modes and methods. It is abundantly clear that Europe is most at ease when it is in conversation with itself. Furthermore, when Europe sets out to engage beyond itself, it can only do so by setting the terms of that engagement both in manner and means. In the academic and or cultural sense, this is both epistemological and terminological. As Jacques Derrida points out in The University Without Condition, the modern university is built on the foundations of Europe, wherever in the world it might be, and the same can be said for the theatre, with tragedy as one of its foundational pillars. Europe is, of course, not only a fact of geography, but a pervasive and persistent force across the globe that shapes the possibility of engagement on all fronts, not least the academic and cultural fronts. This makes it impossible for the other, the African, for example, to engage except within the epistemological space of the European. It is, of course, also true that Africa is not a fact of geography, but a pervasive presence, if not exactly yet a force, across the globe. That the result of colonialism, beyond the obvious degradation of the life worlds of Africans, is the creation of an African presence within Europe or the European, both in the obvious geographical sense, but also in the sense in which Africans have accommodated themselves to the European epistemologically, across a sliding scale of expertise from everyday survival to the extreme specialization of academic discourse and practice. This has produced a category of Africans highly accomplished in such discourses and practices and a Eurocentricism that permeates through Africa itself, particularly and most obviously in sites and institutions of culture and learning. With the above in mind, Retags is conceived of part of what's become known as Southern theory, the production of theory and or refiguration of a conceptual field from the vantage point of the global South. In their 2012 book, Theory from the South, Jean and John Komaroff, anthropologists from the University of Chicago with a long working relationship in Africa, suggest the possibility that in the present moment, it is the global South that affords privileged insight into the workings of the world at large, rather than being a laboratory or source of raw data for the production of insights in the global north. Their argument is basically that modernity is a world historical production, a collaboration of north and south, and it can as well be narrated from its undersides as it can from its self-proclaimed centers. They are at pains to make clear that they are not seeking to simply turn the story upside down, nor do they see the south and north as clearly demarcated entities. Their contention is that, and I quote, while there is much south in the north and much north in the south, the global south does also manifest as an eccentric location, an elsewhere to mainstream Euro-America, and its importance lies in that eccentricity, in the angle of vision it provides us from which to estrange our world in its totality in order better to make sense of its present and future, end quote. Such a perspective accepts the impossibility of escaping from the conceptual terminology of the Euro-American disciplinary framework and its epistemologies. However, it sets about reimagining such concepts and terminologies in ways that make them mutate to become useful in counter-hegemonic ways. The project builds on my lengthy experience with tragedy in the theatre and in Africa, but significantly it is also inspired by my reading of the recent work of David Scott and of Hans-Thys Liermann. For Scott, in rough summary, the history of anti-colonialism and its aftermath has traditionally been framed through the trope of romance, the triumph of good after trials and tribulations. Such a framing is dependent on a utopian horizon towards which the narrative proceeds. This has led to a triumphalist narrative of salvation and redemption in which the evil colonial regime is overthrown by the steadfast persistence and bravery of the people and or the anti-colonial hero who emerge victorious at the end. Scott examines the revisions C.L.R. James made in 1963 to the Black Jacobins, originally published in 1938, to suggest a shift of the narrative framing to the trope of tragedy, and uses this to argue that tragedy as a framework for the implotment of historical narrative is more appropriate to the actual lived reality of the tangible ruins of our present, the congealing context of our post-colonial time. Here there is no longer a visionary horizon of new beginnings, but a profound skepticism about the teleologies of nationalist and socialist liberation. In his second book, Scott goes on to link this tragic turn to a particular conception of time, in which, as he puts it, and I quote, "the existential rhythms of that enduring relation between past, present, and future have been broken, and a certain experience of temporal afterness prevails, in which the trace of future's past hangs like the remnant of a voile curtain over what feels uncannily like an endlessly extending present." End of quote. For Liermann, most studies of tragedy focus on what he defines as dramatic tragedy, a particular form that arises in the Renaissance despite its foundations being laid centuries before by Aristotle in the Poetics. Such studies tend to ignore tragedy either in its non-dramatic forms, either pre-dramatic or post-dramatic, or as a theatrical art form which amounts to more than simply what is manifest in the written text. In other words, if we are to understand the tragedies of writers such as Aeschylus, Sophocles, or Euripides, Liermann suggests, we must take into consideration that they were never conceived or experienced as dramatic or simply as text-based artworks independent of their actuality and performance. Liermann goes on to suggest that there are two broad conceptions of tragedy, what he calls the conflict model following Aristotle, Hegel, and Schiller, and the transgression model following Nietzsche, Bataille, and Lacan. The conflict model involves the repeated clash of powerfully irreconcilable differences, usually between personal autonomy and social and legal demands based on tradition and historical authority. The transgression model invokes the power of rupture located in and or outside the subject, an overstepping of borders and a display of excess that may be ecstatic and singularly intense, yet calls forth ruin. He suggests that while these two models are not mutually exclusive, a focus on dramatic tragedy lends most often to the former, and that if we were to examine tragedy in non-dramatic modes, the latter, the transgression model, would come more into focus. I'm interested, following Scott, in exploring the ways in which the time matrix beyond the formal colonial regime might be imagined as tragic rather than romantic. In order to shift the focus of inquiry beyond the triumphalism of how we got here to what we are experiencing now. I'm interested, following Liermann, in understanding how tragedy has been reconfigured in the post-colonial theatres of Africa, how moments of tragic excess are being enacted outside of the theatre in the course of revolts against neo-colonial establishments and forces, and how in an embodied performative manner tragedy might be utilized as a tool for understanding the present regime of time and its performative effects in the post-colony, understood as the whole global neo-colonial complex that characterizes the world as it is emerging now across all hemispheres. The project consists of a number of streams, including one, the study of the archive of post-colonial tragedies produced by an earlier generation in the immediate aftermath of direct colonial rule, with a specific focus on theatricality. 2, performance analysis of instances of excessive revolt outside of the theatre, mostly enacted by a younger generation in the neocolonial aftermath. And 3, artistic research investigations of tragedy or the tragic, using anthropologist Tim Ingold's art as inquiry model, in which thinking arises in the course of making, or in Aaron Manning and Brian Massumi's terms, making as thinking through action. While Stream 1 focuses on formal theatrical elements as they were developed in the historical period in question, Stream 2 focuses on content insofar as it attempts to unpack the specific dynamics and textures of a more current moment. Then Stream 3 attempts to experiment practically with the intersection of the formal and the content outcomes of the first 2 streams through the performance projects and workshops. Okay, so part 2 focuses on a production that I've done recently called Antigone, Not Quite, or Quiet, or Not Quite Quiet, which was done last year in 2019 by Magnet Theatre. So Sophocles' Antigone is a play about a society at the dawn of democracy coming to terms with the aftermath of a civil war. A society struggling to, unable perhaps, to deal with its dead. It is also a play about the irreconcilable division of systems of law, of gender, and of generations. But this is not a production of Sophocles' Antigone. Antigone, Not Quite or Quiet, is a set of responses to the play Antigone from the perspective of 3 of the play's characters, Ismene, Antigone, Tiresias. The production is structured in 3 sections. The first section, Ismene, is a solo piece performed by Jenny Resnick, white, female, 60 years old, dressed in white and covered in white makeup from head to foot. It runs for about 45 minutes and is based on a text written by Resnick, which plays out like an extended soliloquy or aria. The first section is most closely aligned to what might be understood as drama. Here, the very old Ismene is trapped, one, in a perpetual existence, that, 2, involves a constant return to what she believes to be the grave or tomb of Antigone, and a repeated retelling of the story of the family of Oedipus again and again for eternity. This idea arose from what I understood to be Antigone's dual injunction in the original play for Ismene to live and to proclaim. In the first scene between the sisters, when Antigone attempts to get Ismene to help her with the burial and Ismene refuses, in the Anne Carson version, you go on worrying about the gods of life and proclaim it to all, I insist. In the E.F. Watling version, live if you will, live and defy the holiest laws of heaven and publish it to all the world, else I shall hate you more. The first section is a torrent of words with little by way of outright dramatic action. Again, this is motivated by lines in the original play, Antigone telling Ismene, who has refused to act but then wishes to go with her sister to her death, I love no friend whose love is only words. But despite this lack of action and surfeit of words, there is a language of heightened gesture woven into the verbal delivery, and there are 2 specific points at which the words cease and are replaced with short dance sequences using classical ballet vocabulary in which the performer Resnick and the character Ismene seem to teeter on the edge of catastrophe and collapse. This first section is also very much about the theatre. It refers back to the theatre as an institution, to its modes of practice and to other plays and theatre makers as it depicts Ismene's tragic struggles. It also never attempts to hide the fact that it is theatre. The mechanics of the theatre are obvious for all to see. The second section, Antigone, focuses on Antigone trapped in the cave or death. It is performed by a 13-person chorus, a multiple embodiment of the eponymous heroine of Sophocles' play, all but one black, a mix of male and female, but all wearing black dresses and all under 35 years old, most in their 20s. It is a 40-minute vocal musical work composed and arranged by Naomi Younger. It is made up in part of original material based on poetic text in response to the play Antigone, written for the production by poet Mandisa Vundla, in part of struggle songs, church music and laments, and in part of fragments of text from the original play. It can best be described as post-dramatic in style, to use Hans Tisleman's term. It also uses dance and physicality alongside or interspersed with the verbal text, but this time the vocabulary is based on contemporary South African street dance forms. This section can best be described as Antigone's scream, the resounding voice of the youth of the new South Africa, angry with the slow pace of change, with the corruption of their parents' generation, who, when handed the precious possibility of freedom, were unable or unwilling to care for it. It also references the so-called fallist movements on university campuses in South Africa, the Roads Must Fall and Fees Must Fall movements of 2015 and 2016 that spread elsewhere, including here, the Marikana massacre in August 2012, in which 17 striking mine workers from a Lonmin-owned platinum mine in Rustenburg in the Northwest Province were shot and killed by police, and 78 more injured, and the continued exploitation of the working class in South Africa, especially in the mining sector, and violence against women and children, which is reaching epic proportions in South Africa. The rape and murder of UCT first-year student Uyeneni Mkhwetwana by a worker in a post office where she had gone to send a parcel, and the subsequent national protests against gender-based violence that erupted in response took place in September 2019 in the middle of the rehearsal process for the production. In the production, in the Ismeni section, we start in bright light, which gradually darkens until it becomes black at the end, which Ismeni takes to be an attempt to silence her. Despite this, she continues to prattle on, her amplified voice fighting to remain audible in the face of the impending darkness, and then out of the dark itself. She becomes more and more marginal as she slips off the back end of the stage and then literally disappears into the darkness. The Antigone section, in contrast, begins in the dark and grows increasingly lighter as it continues until right at the end the chorus rolls a gantry forward towards the audience with a row of strong stage lights shining directly in the audience's eyes that gradually increase in intensity, literally blinding the audience. While they do this, the chorus sings lines from the first choral ode in the original play. Hail the sun, the brightest of all that ever dawned on the city. Hail the golden dawn, rising to speed the flight of the white invaders, homeward in full retreat. Hail the sun, hail the sun, hail the sun. These first two sections are performed on a flat, raised, rectangular stage that seems to float off the ground. In the center of the stage is a door, complete with doorknob, set into the floor. Off stage at the sides are 13 chairs on the ground level, split between right and left. Ismeni is understood to be on one side of the door, desperately trying to make contact with her sister on the other side, below the door, and trying to get through the door to follow Antigone. Antigone is understood to be on the underside of the door, and when the second section begins, the door is open and the chorus emerge from underneath. These first two sections are conceived as lying parallel to each other. Neither character is able to hear the other, and while Ismeni certainly tries to engage her sister, she receives no response. On the other hand, it is unclear whether Antigone is even aware of Ismeni's continued existence on the other side of the door. This is highlighted in the final moments of the first section, when the chorus enter to take up their places on the chairs, stage right and left, as Ismeni continues her monologue. Neither Ismeni or the Antigone chorus seem to be aware of the presence of the other. The third section, Tiresias, is a rendition of Tiresias' vision in a 15-minute video installation focused on blindness on the three flat-screen TVs mounted like a triptych at the back of the rectangular space. The text here is a poem in isiXhosa by S.E.K. Mqhayi, written in 1908, about the relationship between the amaXhosa king Gqika and his dog Mbambushe. The poem with the title Mbambushe Induna Kalwaganda, Mbambushe, the headman or counselor of Luganda, is preceded here as in the original by a contextualizing story in English in which the king gives his dog so much violent power over the community that the dog eventually turns on the king himself, and the king is forced to kill the dog with his own hands. The poem itself is a meditation on leadership or the lack thereof, and has an idiomatic subtitle. Ninganiki okunkwele ezinjeni, give not unto dogs sacred things, which became the subtitle for the production too. The section completes the shift of style or mode from drama to live performance to screen media. The relationship to the audience across the three sections is important to the overall dramaturgy. In the first section, Ismeni, the convention is direct address. Ismeni talks directly to the audience, openly acknowledging their presence and posing open-ended questions to them. The audience, in her eyes, sit in judgment over her. She is obsessed by the idea that the audience find her to be unbearable. One of her first lines, said to herself when she becomes aware of their presence, is, "Shit, an audience. How embarrassing." She is embarrassed or ashamed by her interminable age, by the fact that she did nothing to help Antigone, but mostly because of her whiteness. A whiteness that is recognized to be responsible for the excesses of the past of colonialism and apartheid. But also a whiteness that will not or perhaps cannot go away. Ismeni's persistent and unending return as a character from antiquity and as a part of this particular production, doomed to enter the stage again and again each night, the existential condition of all theatrical beings. Ismeni's tragic paradox, if you will, is that she cannot leave in the sense of die, despite being desperate to join her sister in death and thereby to put an end to this interminable repetition filled with shame. But she also does not want to leave in the sense of exit the stage because of her fear of non-existence, irrelevance, and of non-being. The lighting design referred to above aids in provoking her shame. She is caught in a tension between the bright light that exposes her as one of those to be despised and the darkness that she feels or fears is trying to annihilate her and that she fights desperately to resist by staying alive on the stage even when she can no longer be seen.
Someone has been scratching on the outside of the stone, leaving the marks. Scratching. With me, trying to get in, trying to follow her when I knew that I could not, trying to disobey her. Trying to die like her and my sister, my own sister. We are the same husband, unfolding in different directions. It is a foreign land that I cannot visit. I don't want you long to. Despised. But then, an interaction.
Shut up, you say. We are sick of your noise, your vehemence, your words going on and on and on, your moaning, your deluded sense of self-importance, your guilt, your shame. Shame! Last we saw, your dress was still the hammers up on the hill, but on your table. Easy, easy, old rule. Famous be the air, the air. We can't breathe, you say, while you go on. Well, go on! Do it for me! I'm sure you've got a gun or a suitable weapon loaded and ready on your lap!
It would be so easy! Just put it down on the back of my head with a broken bottle to add to the statistics!
Go on! Be my guest! Shut me up!
The choral performances that make up the Antigone section exist in a kind of hybrid mode with regard to the audience. The Antigone chorus doesn't address the audience in the kind of ceaselessly direct way that Ismene does. They don't, however, ignore the audience either in the manner of the so-called fourth wall, often looking straight at them or singing in their direction. The possibility even exists that some in the audience might join in the singing when recognizable melodies or songs emerge. But their performance is not ultimately meant for the audience. It is the chorus's own expression of pain, anger, despair, confusion, discomfort, and protest. The fact that the audience gets to receive this is a kind of coincidence. The audience happens to be present to witness what is part protest, part ritual, and inevitably are affected. The Antigone chorus expresses the condition of blackness continuing to struggle against the power of whiteness that continues to control so much of the society 26 years after the supposed end of apartheid. And of the black youth in particular, whose tragic condition is characterized what has become known as unfreedom. They have acquired freedom in terms of the law, but do not have the power to benefit from it. They cannot free themselves from the suffocating coloniality that determines so much of their being.
Oh. enough to pray to death, to ask release from death of all the limb and the leg to hang, to hope. What hope? Filthy hope, docile hope. Hope, you whore!
I am not here to understand. I am here to say no and to die
in a rock-hewn chamber of endless
you.
In the final section, Tiresias, the mode once again shifts to a direct address to the audience, but this time between the fragmented digital disembodied voice on the screens and the live audience. Here there is no possibility of dialogue or a talking back. The voice on the screens, supported by the chorus who are now dancing in the chairs on either side of the stage, cannot be stopped or silenced. I know this is a language that we can't understand, but I just want to show some of the imagery that went into this. On one level, the audience is rendered more and more passive as the sections unfold. On another level, they become more and more implicated in the performance itself, complicit in the situation through their blind acquiescence, their willingness to turn a blind eye despite there being so much violence obvious for all to see. This is the condition of all theatre audiences. They sit on their hands, watching, feeling, doing nothing. In this sense, the audience and Tiresias mirror each other. They see the future unfolding, but they do not have the means to change it. After the story in English and the poem in Isikosa, the head of Tiresias floating on each of the three screens addresses the audience for a final time, quoting in part from the play Les Aveugles, the Blind, by Maurice Maeterlinck, written in 1890, at the point of transition from the 19th to the 20th century, and responding to the anxiety of that time. I'm not actually going to play this, but basically it starts off and says, "And so here we are, we have arrived, the two of us, a blind seer and a choir of blind watchers faced off against each other." And then it describes lines from the play, and it says, "In the history of the theatre, 12 blind souls let loose on an island at the top of a cliff overhanging the sea, with the weather out of control, wait for their spiritual guide to arrive. But unbeknownst to them, he is already there, lying dead on the stage amongst them." And then it ends with the lines, "Don't be afraid. There's nothing to be afraid of. We are all here together." At which point the heavens burst, but instead of raining water, stones rain onto the empty stage and cover up the doorway, even as we hear Ismene calling from off stage the lines that started the first section to begin the cycle again. The production was conceived from a perspective in time that we might call our post-colonial present, which is tragic in the way that it cannot escape the shameful past that is supposed to have passed, but continues to haunt our every current moment. In this respect, it is about remembering, a desperate attempt to put together a fractured body. But the dramaturgical impulse arose from a realization of how separated we are so many years after the supposed end of apartheid. How, despite the fact that we continue to live together in close proximity, we do not or cannot wish or wish not to see or understand each other across intersecting divisions of class, race, gender, sexuality. Like the three parts of this triptych, we reach but cannot touch. We touch but cannot bind into any sense of a whole. We remain inevitably inconvenient to each other, immovable from our common landscape. Despite lofty ambitions of reconciliation and social cohesion, or our deepest, darkest desires to be rid of each other, we are stuck together, and we are blind. Tiresias was blinded by the sight of the naked body of Athena. We have been blinded by the promise of freedom. So valuable, and yet we have blindly handed it over, entrusted it to those in power, those without apparent care or concern or comprehension. And in our blindness, we are uncomfortable and angry and ashamed, with no alternative but to carry on together. So, what is the time? I'm going to
check. 25 past 6.
And you want to finish it?
No, well...
Okay. I just want to speak in quickly about the production in the context of other work that I've done. And Antigone, Not Quite Quiet, is the third production that I've done over the past 25 years that uses ancient Greek tragedy as its source, but adapts it to reflect on the context of a South Africa trying to emerge from colonialism and apartheid. The first was a version of Medea in 1994, at the point at which South Africa was moving from the system of apartheid into a new dispensation. The adaptation focused on the clash of cultures between the apparently barbarian Colchian culture of Medea and the apparently civilized Thessalian culture of Jason. And in a review of the piece, Maggie Metsabota described it as a theatrical document of the new South Africa that has made an excitingly positive statement. The second production was a version of the Orestes Electra narrative titled In the City of Paradise in 1998, in response to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission process, and was staged again in 2015 with a new generation of young performers who were responding to the consequences of the policy of reconciliation proposed by the Mandela government post-1994. And here the piece focuses very much on the difficulties and compromises required in order to deal with themes of revenge and justice in the aftermath of the apartheid era. Now, across, and then Antigone is the third one in this kind of trilogy. Across these three productions, there are shifts evident in three respects. In respect of content and how it speaks back to the contemporary socio-political reality of the country, in respect of the theatrical form of the performance itself, and in respect of what I will call the strategy of adaptation. So quite clearly, there is a shift from a very positive feeling in Medea to the complexity of the City of Paradise, and then in Antigone, something altogether more difficult and discomforting as the reality of our neo-apartheid context sinks in. In terms of theatrical form, all three productions emphasize physical aspects of performance. They use heightened vocal modes such as chant and song. All three productions focus the choruses central. However, while the first two productions follow a clear narrative line recognizably linked to an ancient tragic source, but shaped to reflect on local circumstances, in the third production, there is no clear narrative to follow. The link with an original narrative seems broken. The narrative is referred to as background but not enacted. Ismene particularly tries to retell the story of her family, touching on events across the whole trilogy. But despite her best attempts, all that we get are fragments, references to a narrative that seems to belong elsewhere in another place and time, delivered at breakneck speed, making any attempt to piece a story together extremely difficult, if not entirely hopeless. So this leads me on to what I term above the strategy of adaptation and how that has changed across the three productions. In the first two productions, while there's no single text that the adaptation is based on and multiple sources are drawn on to augment the original narrative, there is an explicit relationship in the adaptation to a point of origin. In other words, I would describe the strategy of adaptation as enacting a narrative relationship with its sources. In Antigone, Not Quite Quiet, however, the relationship to the sources is only implicit. What binds the three parts of the structure together is what I suggest is an archival relationship to Sophocles' play. or perhaps an anarchival relationship, to be more precise. Derrida uses the term anarchive when describing the drive to archive in archive fever. Elisa Adami and Alessandra Farini note that, and I quote, the Greek prefix ana means both above and against, but also upside down and wrong. In this sense, the anarchival is at once a feature integral to the proper functioning of the archive, a force that opposes its traditional authoritarian institution, and playful improper use of archives and archival practices, end quote. For Brian Massumi, the anarchive is not documentation of a past activity. It is best defined as a repertory of traces. The traces are not inert, but are carriers of potential. They are reactivatable, and their reactivation helps trigger a new event which continues the creative process from which they came, but in a new iteration. Or as André Lepecki puts it with reference to dance works based on older dance works from the archive, the capacity to identify in past work still non-exhausted creative fields of impalpable possibilities. In the first two productions, the source plays are related to as objects of the classical archive that frame, shape, and organize a reflection on the present. However, in the final production, the play is not so much taken to be an object of the archive as it is made of the formative movements going into and coming out of the archive, for which the objects contained in the archive serve as springboards. The anarchive as such is made of formative tendencies, compositional forces seeking a new taking form, lures for further process, in the words of Massumi. So this anarchival new taking form that is Antigone not quite quiet has a disruptive, playful, and improper relationship to the archive that unsettles its authority and its capacity to delimit our possibilities. In these days, if there is a place for the colonial archive in Africa, it can no longer be an easy relationship. We are no longer easy and obedient subjects of the archive and its apparent totality of knowledge. While we might not be exactly disconnected, we are not determined by it either. Thank you.
Very much, Mark. That was really, really interesting. And I suppose, following on from what you've just said, I also felt during the course of your talk, I wanted really to hear more about your process. You know, to what extent? I mean, especially with your third production, is this a devised piece? Where does it begin? Especially. If you're working with the concept of an archive, you are. Does it begin with your chorus? Does it begin, as a kind of storyboard? Where does it come from?
Well, this began very much from a point in the middle of the 2015-2016 Fallist movements and the occupation of the campus and the shutting down of the university and all of this, and sitting there in the middle of it, realizing that there was no point of contact, that between black and white, if you will, we were existing in the same space. We probably thought very similar things about certain issues, but we were not touching. And it felt to me that this fundamental relationship between Ismene on the one side of this door and Antigone on the other side was one in which they were obviously linked, but they were not able to communicate in any kind of way. They'd gone their separate paths. And that sense in South Africa today that white people cannot engage blackness, and that black people ultimately don't want white people to be there, particularly the young black people that I teach. But it's a fact of history that we are, and we're not going anywhere. Was a kind of bind, double bind, if you like, that was very intractable, very difficult to deal with. So that was really the starting point of this whole thing. So I thought, okay, let me make a piece in which I don't try, because there's a big question about bringing white and black bodies together on stage. How do they actually speak to each other? So this kind of non-racial kind of idealism that I was brought up with, and that the other two productions definitely, certainly in the Medea was trying to bring to the fore just wasn't working. So I thought, okay, well, if Ismene is the white part, and if you like, and Antigone is the black part, how would I do? So in my conception, if Antigone died, then she is the same age as she was when she went in to the cave or whatever. And Ismene has just been living forever. So the idea was to take a white body that was aging and to try to think about it from the perspective of this persistence of whiteness, right? And I worked entirely separately with Jenny on that section. And she wrote the piece after lots of conversation. So there was actually a text to work off. And so that worked like theatre in the sense that there was a play and there was a text and we could work with it. On the other side, and the whole question there was really, well, how much physicality, how much words, what was the thing? And I was interested in Simon Critchley's discussion of Electra, where he's talking about the fact that she just kind of laments almost continuously from about 100 lines into the play to the end without any much action. And I thought, okay, well, that's what Ismene sounds like that to me, so let's follow through that idea. And there are these two balletic moments, which with Mendelssohn music playing in this kind of classical mode, and which keep kind of wanting to collapse, because although she's working very hard to do the port de bras and everything properly, she's 60 and struggling to stay upright. So that was the first part. The second part was to say, well, these young people that I'm working with, mainly made up of there were students, the master students who were part of the project, and there were trainees, performers from Magna Theatre. There was only one white student, the rest all black. To say, right, you are the chorus. So this idea of a chorus of Antigone, if you like, as this kind of multiple figure, this crowd, this kind of protesting force, this thing. And then I said to Nao Muyango, who's a long-time collaborator and composer, you work with them initially. Compose music, create song, create things. So that process was completely separate. And then I thought, okay, the third part, which has to be this thing, the Stiresias thing, I'll just work, and the third actor, Fanny Soyisa, was not available. She's in the film that's just been nominated for the International Category of Academy Award. So she's busy doing the film, and I knew that I had, like, a week with her, of her time. So what can I do with her in a week? So the thing that I thought immediately was, okay, I'm just going to film her, because I've got a week, I can film her in a week, right? And then it came to me that the third part would just be on that screen. And it would just be this like disembodied talking head speaking directly to the audience on this theme of blindness. So that's how it worked. I worked separately with all three, just running from one rehearsal room to the other and each time changing. So it was only after Nao had composed the whole thing, it was just material, that I just came into the room and just started to link things together. And what was really interesting was just how, across these three separate processes, same images just kept coming up. So there's a character, the person in the Marikana massacre who was killed, called Mbambush. And nobody knew why he was called Mbambush. And everybody's walking around saying, why is this character called Mbambush? And he was a figure, and the song was, they were singing a song about him. And then I looked at the poem by Nkai, written in 1908, and the dog's name is Mbambush. And it was like this coincidence that just popped out of nowhere. So this thing of dogs, right, kept coming up. There were dogs everywhere. Jenny had written about dogs in the Ismene section. There's a Mbambush is the name of a dog in this thing, in the last section. The songs in the middle had dogs. So there were dogs everywhere in the production. These things just kept occurring. So there was this interesting multiple process. And then I was working with the various versions of the plays, all the plays of the kind of Theban trilogy, if you like, and the Seven Against Thebes to kind of extend it outwards, and just pulling out things and trying to understand them in relation to what these performers were doing on the stage.
So you can gather outside. Sorry, there is no official drink here, but we'll go somewhere else. But can can you join me and thank Mark so much for a really, really rich and exciting talk. So thank you so much.